Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 7th, 2016, and welcome to episode 133 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and recovery. So, I'm joined here by several people who I just recently saw in Kansas City, Missouri. First, I guess we'll start with... Who will we start with? Let's start with Carrington in Toronto. How are you, Carrington?
I'm amazing. You just met me. You know that.
Yes.
You didn't just meet me, but you just saw me.
Yes. Then also in Australia, we have Michael Mulhern. How are you, Michael?
Oh, I'm coming to grips with not having 24-hour retroness.
Yes.
It's difficult.
Indeed. Also, sharing a city with me is Ken Gagne in Boston. How are you, Ken?
Paul, not only did I see you in Kansas City, I saw you in the 1,500 miles in the air between there and Boston.
Yes, how true. We flew back... On the same plane. I had a better Southwest number than you, though, as I recall.
Very, yes. You remembered to check in online. I was too exhausted from K-Fest to even think about what might happen the next day.
Yeah. So this is kind of a shambles of an episode. The host's topic today is...
Wow, way to set expectations, Paul.
How do you recover? So all of us are now back in our respective countries after Kansas Fest. It just so happens that all of us who are on the episode today were just in Kansas City at Kansas Fest, and we're sort of recovering. So the best we could come up with the topic is how do you recover? How's it going? What has happened to you since Kansas Fest? What did you think of Kansas Fest and other related topics? So I guess my sort of feeling about it is I'm just sort of coming back online after the event. It's been was very intense. It was a huge amount of fun. It was great, but it's taking a little while to ramp back up. So I'm just curious to know what others of you think, and if you have any thoughts about Kansas Fest, we might as well put them in here. So, Michael, you had the longest flights.
Yes, I was just smiling at you saying that you had 1,500 miles of flying, and I was sort of wishing that's all I had to do. But no, I enjoyed Kansas Fest, but I think I arrived with almost zero energy level at the start of it, because I'd already done 18,000 kilometers of flights and train and just general touring on my way to Kansas Fest. I had to ramp myself up just to start with, but. Kansas Fest, for me, it was great. I loved how, for something that's supposed to be celebrating the Apple, we managed to have so many non-Apple enthusiasts there. It was great to have all that extra retro goodness there. And I'm going to quickly beat Carrington to the punch. It was the people. I loved it for the people.
Right.
But no, it is the... one of the things that I love is getting out there and meeting folks. So I've really got to try and figure out for next year how to get some extra retro events into my schedule so that I can spend all of my time up in North America and get to see some new people and experience some new retro computing festivals. But now that I'm back home, I'm even more drained than I was before. It's one of those things. You throw everything that you've got into these conferences, and sometimes I think that I might not be as young as I used to be, and I just can't handle the hectic pace as well as I used to. But glad to be home, glad to be getting on with some projects here. I think it's something that we all just need just to start just plodding on and just slowly ramping it up. And maybe I'll be 100% just in time to attend Kansas Fest 2017.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know, Michael, when you attended your first K-Fest, you were so young and sprightly, but that was so long ago.
Yeah,
and in the intervening years, you've just really gone downhill.
Intervening year, I've been working on my acreage out here. I think that it's one of those things. I've got to find time for doing retro projects. I've got to find time for taming the bush that's encroaching on my backyard. And then I've got to still be a smiling, bubbling, effervescent personality when I meet all you lovely people.
Right. Yeah, I know that I think this was maybe the fifth. I was at Kansas Fest 2012 and ever since. And every year I always think, all right, I'm going to bank sleep ahead of time. And
it doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Just never, never, ever happens. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what the right strategy is, but it was, so one of the things I noticed was that it was definitely, over that short, relatively short number of years, it has diversified a fair amount. And I think, you know, that obviously a lot of the people who are into the Apple II also are interested in other kind of retro computers as well. But there are, it was neat to get a chance to actually see some of the, like the other podcasters, for example, from the other platforms, even though I did manage to focus pretty much exclusively on Apple II stuff while I was there. So, Carrington, how are you? Faring on your return?
Fantastic. No recovery at all. This year was the most casual of my Kansas Fests, I think. I did no presentation. I didn't enter Hackfest. I did basically nothing. I took a vacation in Kansas City, Missouri, and I hung out with people that I love, and I talked about retro computing. So I got more than enough sleep, even though there were a lot of very late nights, but I don't need a lot of sleep. And since I wasn't frantically working on a project, I was just taking notes for a write-up about Kansas Fest I'll be doing for Juice.js. But other than that, it was a very casual week for me. And so I ended it with tons of enthusiasm and tons of energy. I find in general, actually post-Kansas Fest for me is not a time where I'm exhausted, but a time where I'm re-energized and excited to work on Apple II projects. And I have a lot of dreams for the year, most of which historically do not come to fruition, and the next Kansas Fest will arrive. I'm like, already? It's been a year? I didn't get any of that stuff done. So probably that'll be the case again this year. And on a side note, though, the only thing I did have to recover from is I think another reason why Michael might have been a little tired this year is he showed up with a form of the plague. Ask me how I know that, Michael.
Carrington, how would that be?
Because you are the 12 monkeys of retro computing, and you gave me your nonsense. But I have finally shaken it, mostly. But yes, I picked up Michael's cough, and I want to give it away.
Excellent. Well, that sounds actually quite nice to spend a slightly less intense. Maybe 2017 I'll do the same thing. Though Carrington,
no, I kind of regret it. I will not do that again. Next year I will want to do multiple presentations and Hackfest and the tie contest and everything. I get more out of it and a little bit more enjoyment if I sort of put more into it. I would like to be more exhausted by the end of the next Kansas Fest, and I want to be a little bit more participatory. I don't know.
Though you did a fair amount of work maybe on the way there, making work for everybody else on your door. Yeah.
Yes. But that was a lot more work for other people than for me. But yes, I did an interactive door again this year, and it was a pirate-based scavenger hunt. So you'd start on the door, and if you deciphered the first clue there, it would lead you to the next location where there would be another clue, and there were 10 locations in all, the last of which was a tiny buried treasure chest. And Paul was one of the people who actually solved it.
You were right on the last night.
Right on the last night. In fact, nobody solved it until I think the day before. So it went to, like, number one was the day before, and people who solved it last were I think on Sunday, actually. Somebody found it on Sunday just as I was picking everything up, so it was scrambling around behind me to pick up the clues, and with some assistance got to the end just before I did.
It was very cool. Are you going to – I suppose there's no way to kind of publish or recreate that.
No, there is. Yeah, no, it'll be – I'm just going to figure out where to put it. I'll probably stick it up on a sub-page of Monster Feed or something. But I have a rough draft, which I'll polish up in the next couple of weeks. I took photos of every location, both zoomed out and zoomed in on the clue. And so I will make a little walkthrough website. And you go to the first one, read the clue, try to think about what it would be, and then just maybe click and it'll show you the next location. That's how it works at the moment. So not a lot of puzzle solving if you don't want to work at it, but it will show everybody how the game was run and what you would have won if you were able to solve it.
Excellent. Cool.
Is that just going to be a walkthrough, or are you going to build like a Twine game?
No, just a walkthrough.
Okay.
I'm way too lazy. No, it'll simply be, here's the clue. Click on it to see where it would have led. Like, that's it. Putting very little effort into it.
So, Ken, how's your recovery?
Well, like Carrington, I like to be involved in Kansas Fest, and I've struggled in trying to find that happy medium. There were some years where I was just doing way too much and was so exhausted halfway through Kansas Fest that I just wanted to go home by Thursday, and I knew that wasn't healthy. So I backed off and tried doing nothing and was really bored, and that wasn't good. I think I found the happy medium this year. I gave only one or two formal presentations, but what really did it for me was noticing that last year, nobody was tweeting from the official Kansas Fest account. It pretty much was silent while all the committee members were busy actually putting on the event. So I went to them this year and asked, if you don't have somebody assigned to do that for you, may I? And they said, sure. And so I got to do all the live tweeting for the week, which meant that all these photos I take, which usually just sit on my hard drive, guilting me over the fact that I haven't published them to Facebook or anything for another year or so, I actually got to publish them in real time. I got to tweet them out while the presentations were still ongoing. And I got to use hashtags and tweet at people, for example. Carrington, you and Quinn and Michael and somebody else I'm not thinking of right now, we're all playing the Load Runner board game. Who was the fourth player?
I remember that I did it, but that's all I remember. But I didn't know that you were the one who did that tweeting, so I appreciate that, because I had noticed this year there was a lot more of that from the official K-Fest Twitter account, and so I was enjoying reading that even while I was there. So thank you very much, Kim.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, so I took a photo of you playing the Load Runner board game, and I tweeted it at Doug Smith's daughter to let her know that this game was being played. Doug Smith, of course, being the creator of the Load Runner game for the Apple II.
Which is why I got that cease and desist letter from him.
No, I don't think that was it. But it was just nice to be able to reach out to people and let them know that these events were happening. And I enjoyed all the interaction that resulted. And it gave me an outlet, and it gave me some responsibility, which I really enjoyed. The other responsibility I had, of course, was taking Andy Malloy on a walking tour of Rockhurst University and showing him how to play Pokemon Go. Mm-hmm. That was fun. But as for recovery, I take a day off after I get back from Kansas Fest just to catch up on stuff around the house. And I usually end up coming home from Kansas Fest, like Carrington, pretty energized and wanting to work on projects. I had a JuiceGS staff meeting at Kansas Fest where we brainstormed features for the next year. And there's so much great content that we could be writing, that we will be writing, that it makes it much easier to envision what the next few issues of JuiceGS will be coming from Kansas Fest. So I'm really excited. I'm really energized. The only downside is that Kansas Fest reminds me how good life could be. And then I come back to real life and it's very disheartening. You know, like when you get used to something sucking, you just kind of forget that it sucks because you get so used to it. And then you are reminded that things don't have to suck, which just makes everything suck all the more.
My real life's amazing. I just wanted to share that with the group.
I feel better for knowing that. Thank you, Carrington.
That's what I'm here for.
Yay. Oh.
Everything's coming up, Carrington.
Yeah. I don't want to watch that show.
Yeah, I know that in the like other years I've come back fairly energized, and I definitely still felt like it was too short. I mean, every year goes by quicker, but...
This year seemed to go by faster than most, though. When it was the last day, I felt like I was moving in. Like, it felt like I was ready for it to begin. Maybe because I did less this year, so I had more energy. But I couldn't believe how fast it flew by this year, more than most years.
Yeah.
I did not feel that way. Yeah, I was ready.
No, I
was ready.
I drive. Do you fly? Do you guys, at least some of you must fly, but Ken, do you drive home or do you fly home?
Oh,
you talked about it.
I get to Kansas Fest a different way every year. I have driven from Denver, taken the train from Chicago, bicycled from St. Louis, but my trip...
Have you gone by Vespa?
I have not. Mm-hmm. I have not exhausted the infinite possibilities for commuting to Kansas Fest, but my return home is always a direct flight to Boston.
I think maybe that's another reason why I find it a little easier to recover. What I do is I take the week off for Kansas Fest. I also take the week off after Kansas Fest. See, my life is amazing above. And so I drive back and I take my time and I can get back when I feel like getting back and then go back to work when I feel like going back to work. This year, I actually, I was back in a few days. And so I went in on work on Thursday just because I was home and had enough energy and ready to go, but I didn't need to. So the recovery is a little easier as well because I don't have to recover in any given time span.
Excellent. I'll have to see if I can work that out. Unfortunately, my life in the summer, I'm an academic, and so the summer is mainly unscheduled obligations. So like I can sort of take a week off, but then I just have to do that week's worth of stuff in the following week. So
in some sense, I wish the 5 days of Kansas Fest were actually Monday through Friday, because then I would have an easy travel weekend on either side of it. But if it was the case, then no doubt I would just race down there and hang out afterward on the weekend. Nobody would actually leave until Sunday, so I don't think it would actually solve anything.
Well, the Tuesday of Kansas Fest used to be an unofficial extra day that you would have to pay more to show up that day. And it got to the point where everybody was showing up for the optional day, so they just made it mandatory. They made it a part of the week. Now what's happening is that everybody is showing up Monday night and going out to dinner in the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever they add a day, we add a day until eventually Kansas Fest is just year long.
Yep.
That's a good goal.
Look, Kansas Fest, whatever it is, like 2039 will never end.
Kansas Fest 2017. 2017 is Kansas Fest.
Well, that's certainly going to make commuting to work a bit difficult for me.
Kansas Fest is the bandit.
Nah.
So, for all of you who are not at Kansas Fest, I guess you should consider going next year. also, you will have heard on the feed just prior to this, VCF West is happening right now as we record. It will have happened by the time you hear this. So that's exciting. It's not camping out for a week, but it's still pretty exciting and a lot more big iron. Though Kansas Fest did have a little bit of big iron this time, oddly.
That's true. Somebody just wheeled that into the basement.
Yeah.
And what exactly was it?
I think it was a PDP 8 something.
Tower of Blinking Lights.
Yeah. Looked very pretty. I always like the digital color scheme.
I quite like the green motif that's the one at Living Computer Museum in Seattle, but that's another story.
Yeah, it is very calming.
Yes, very calming. It was very calming.
So, one other note. So you might... It's possible that some of the people who are listening to this will have heard this already, but there was a large recording of many podcasters. So that included Quinn Dunkey of Open Apple, me of Here and Drop 3 Inches, Michael and Carrington of Here also, Kevin of Antic, Rob McMullen of Player Missile, Ken of Here and Polygamer and IndieSider, John Leake of Retro MacCast, Todd George of Chicken Lips Radio, Charles Mangan of How To, a video podcast, and Jeff Saltzman of The History of Personal Computing. And that will be on our feed next after this. So you might have already heard it on Open Apple if you listen to Open Apple. If you don't listen to that, you might like to hear it because it's got many podcasters you might also listen to. And you should listen to Open Apple. But I don't know if there's any. Is there anything that we wanted to say about that before people hear it?
Oh, I don't think we should spoil it. It's got some excellent takeaways.
It's fun to do. It's one of my favorite things of Kansas Fest. I think the only thing that's not as fun about it is that it's essentially a closed session. So all the podcasters will get together, sit in a room because we're trying to make it relatively quiet. So it's one of the few things I do that isn't Well, it's not that it's not open to the public, but it's just not as interactive with everybody else. So that's the one downside. But that aside, it's always a highlight of the year to get together with fellow retro computing podcasters and sort of just wrap in a circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's totally fun, but there are so many people that no one person winds up talking for more than, you know, like 5 minutes. But except you, Carrington.
Challenge accepted.
But anyway, yes, it was a lot of fun to record. It should be at least fun to listen to, we think. So if you've already heard it, though, it's going to be you. There's nothing new in the next one, so you can skip over that.
Or is there?
Oh, yes.
No, there isn't.
Okay. Anyone wanted to throw any last words in about Kansas Fest?
It's fun. People should go. It's not going to be around forever, you know. It's going to stop, and you will regret it if you haven't gone.
You know, that's what got me to go to my first Kansas Fest in 1998, and now I've been to 19 of them, so I'm not sure that threat holds true anymore.
I think it does.
It's probably getting increasingly likely that it will.
Well, especially since, like, last year was the biggest K-Fest I'd ever attended, and this year was the biggest K-Fest I ever attended. And it keeps getting some great publicity, too. I loved that Cult of Mac was there and produced 5 articles and a podcast about us. This is after last year, Motherboard having done a huge feature and a podcast about us. So this is definitely becoming more mainstream.
It's remarkable how many people, though, respond to those things with incredulity, that's a word, that something like Kansas Fest exists. So the majority of people out there are unaware of Kansas Fest. So I think there's a lot of people who would love to go who simply don't know it exists. Mm-hmm. So there does still need to be promotion for it wider than the group of people who already attend.
Yeah, I've seen anecdotally some people who live right in Kansas City who say, I had no idea this was going on. And I'm like, have you ever looked for such a thing? Because it's hard to miss. But that's the thing.
But why would you look for such a thing?
But that's the thing, is that they do have to take the initiative of looking for it. And so when we can get into the mainstream, like Motherboard or Cult of Mac, that's going to hit those people in ways that JuiceGS and OpenApple would not.
Mm-hmm. There may be a Kansas Fest that goes on in my den on weekdays when I'm at work. I don't know.
Right.
Kansas Fest could be anywhere.
Kansas Fest is in our hearts, Carrington. It's everywhere.
Oh,
it is definitely, though, the kind of thing that I could imagine seeing and thinking, you know, that's too much. You know, like if I never sort of thought that, I guess as soon as I heard about it, I went. But I know I was fairly concerned about it at first, thinking, like, what am I getting into? But it does seem like the kind of thing that experiencing it is different somehow from hearing about what it's like. So you will have heard lots about what it's like by now, I'm sure. But still go, despite what you've heard.
Well, I like the fact that it is so long, because I couldn't see myself flying over to just attend VCF this weekend. I know that some people do fly in, but I believe that they also hang around and do something else. But I love how Kansas Fest is literally a week long. I can fly back home afterwards, and even though I lose that day going over the international dateline, it is a bit strange catching a plane on Sunday afternoon and arriving home Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. It's one of the prices you pay for international travel. But I think Kansas Fest is a great length, and as far as VCF goes, I just wish it had been a little bit sooner after Kansas Fest. I would have found some excuse to hang around in the US for an extra week or so, just so that I could attend a VCF. But I'm already planning 2017.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I can segue into listener feedback. So as I mentioned, VCF West is happening right now as I'm speaking. And there actually are some video being recorded. I'm sure there will be some, you know, individual shots of just exhibits, and I think there's also been some kind of live streaming happening.
Yeah, so, there's some photos being posted in our Facebook group. So
That's true.
Yeah, so if people want to have a little bit of a look that's going on, join our Retro Computing Roundtable Facebook group and have a look at the photos.
Yeah, they're pretty impressive. And on that theme, if, you know, Michael, if you'd stayed even just a couple months longer, you could have gone to VCF Midwest. So John Mark wrote in to just alert us to the fact that VCF Midwest 11 is coming up soon. It's at, there's information at vcfmw.org. It is September 10th and 11th in Elk Grove, Illinois. And so this one is, they're moving, I think maybe last year they moved to a new venue, which is costing a little bit more. But one thing that's interesting about VCFMW is that it admission is free. So they are looking for support if you have support to give, just to help, you know, deal with the extra cost that the new venue is. They're hoping not to have to charge admission in the future to handle that. But it, at any rate, at the moment, it is free to go, to exhibit, to sell. It's just sort of a gathering spot. So if you're somewhere near Illinois, September 10th and 11th, definitely check that out. It's it looks like it is quite an interesting event. And I think it's also, it coincides with something else like the Emergency Commodore Computer Convention or something like that. I think they're held at the same, in the same venue. So thanks, John Mark, for that. And also Quinn wrote, so the last time we recorded an episode like this was episode 130, and we had talked about the Apollo Guidance Computer. There was a Hackaday article where Don Iles had brought the source code to the lunar module, Apollo Guidance Computer, and was kind of walking through it. And I think I was the one who was talking about this, and as I was reading that, I wasn't quite clear on how all this stuff fit together, and I still am not quite clear. But there were many people that were working on this Apollo Guidance Computer project, and I didn't quite understand how it all fit together, or how Don Iles fit in with Margaret Hamilton. But we talked about in, I think, it was maybe 123 or something like that. There had been an article posted about Margaret Hamilton and her role in the Apollo Guidance Computer project. And she was basically the, she was the software, she managed the whole team. And she was in charge of the software for the Apollo Guidance Computer for the the main control module, the lunar module, and I think also for Skylab later.
And for listeners, just so you know who she is, she's the one in that amazing, incredible, popular photograph of her standing beside the towering pile of source code.
Yeah, that is a fantastic picture.
Which is just the most iconic photo. Yes, it's like one of my favorite photos. So it's that one. She's that person. She's amazing.
So I didn't mention her before when I was talking about the Don Iles thing, because I didn't quite understand whether this was the same software, the same group. But yeah, they did both work in the same group, and I think they both contributed code to it. Margaret Hamilton was, I suspect, again, it's kind of hard to track all this down, but I think she was kind of she worked her way up to it, but then I think she was overseeing all of it. So that it is connected somewhat. And as I was looking through this, there was in 2001, and I think there were a couple others subsequent to that, there was an Apollo Guidance Computer conference, which at least the pages about this are hosted at Caltech. And there's a pretty interesting discussion in Margaret Hamilton's introduction about kind of her role and how she got to this, how she got to it, how the organization worked. I found that kind of interesting to read. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes, her introduction from the AGC Conference 1. But it's worth actually clicking around through all of that, because there are a lot of people who are participating. I mean, she also participated in the discussions on various aspects of how it was managed and how they dealt with user interface issues and avoiding errors. There's a story that she continues to tell about how she was trying to get some kind of failsafe in to keep people from turning on like launch pre-check mode when you're in flight, and she was told no, we don't want that in there, because that's more code to check and all that stuff, and we train our astronauts to be perfect, and you can guess where that went. But everybody survived. That's the good thing.
I like to think that the AGC conference was held inside Skylab or something. Yeah. Like, it's like Kansas Fest in space.
And without the ability to leave. But anyway, yeah, so thank you, Quinn, for writing and reminding me to kind of attempt to connect the dots. There were a lot of people who worked on this project, but looking through it, I was finding it very hard to figure out exactly which pieces, which people were responsible for. So,
in our feedback, wasn't there something also about the bungee thing that also came in from Quinn?
Yeah, she mentioned, I think also on the last one, we had a prehistory of bungee video, which was basically just, you know, kind of going over their the lead up to when they became sort of like a big current company. And I think they're based in Chicago primarily, but there was a time when they had a Bungie West studio in California, and they were the ones who were responsible for producing the game Oni. And Quinn wrote just to mention that, you know, sort of sad that Bungie West didn't get a mention in there, so we'll mention Bungie West here as a thing that existed and produced Oni. Quinn, in fact, worked for them at that time. So.
Well, that's incredible.
It is. It is. I
no, she's not allowed to be any more cool, so take it back.
Yeah.
She reached some sort of cap. Oni was amazing.
I only saw so I wasn't familiar with the game prior to that, just because it was sort of in a time when I wasn't playing games really. But it looked pretty incredible, you know, when I looked at the videos of it. Anyway, that's a new thing we learned about Quinn and Bungie actually too. Bungie West didn't seem to be very well documented at all. I mean, I looked around a little bit just to see, and there's I think at the maybe it might have been at the release of Oni or a little bit after that, there was kind of like a convention center video, you know, Bungie TV thing that was done. And there was a short tour of the offices where and I think this may have been after Quinn was done there. So they basically just walked around and pointed to people's workstations. It was not very interesting, but it really wasn't very much else that documented it. So it's too bad. Okay, and I think that'll do for listener feedback now. Boy, it's taken us actually quite a long time to get to the items of interest and news.
I blame the host.
Yes, that's fair. So, Carrington, you can act on that by giving us the first one.
I shall act. First one is a link over to fastcodedesign.com, and it is an article about what it was like to work at Xerox PARC, a little place you may have heard of. The title of the article is actually what it was like to work at the most important research and development lab of the past 50 years. So there's that. Anyway, really cool stuff. And of course, we've talked about the Xerox Alto restoration that's been going on lately. And this is, there's a lady, something Stone. What is her name?
Maureen
Stone, it was something like that. So well done, Maureen Stone. So it's not written by her. It's more like a quasi-interview with her and her experiences working there from the early 80s to the very end of the 90s. So essentially 20 years during a really exciting period working in Xerox PARC. Has most of the stuff you would expect, someone would say. Super cool, worked on amazing things. Like you look at the amazing and difficult stuff that they would solve and do, and very interesting. Near the end of the article, it talks about something not very surprising as well, that it was very much a man's world, that she was there for 20 years and would still be mistaken for the other lady with the long hair. But luckily, that's a solved problem in technology, so there's that. So that's quite disappointing, but really, really neat. And anything about Xerox PARC is always interesting, and this is as well. So point everybody to it. The link will be in the show notes, and it is worth a read.
Cool. Yeah, I hadn't seen this, but I will not read it now, but I will read it after the show.
The very top of the article says 5-minute read. Now, I don't know if that's like a dare or something, or an average or what, or if that's maybe this series is called that, but don't take longer than 5 minutes or you're doing it wrong.
Okay. Michael, did you maybe want to talk about the Alto restoration next, since it's thematically related?
Yeah, okay. Well, the Alto was one of my favorite exhibits when I went to the Living Computer Museum. I consider it one of the iconic computer moments in computer history. It's a wonderful workstation, way ahead of its time, and shows the sheer genius of the people that worked in the research center there. Now, there was another Alto restoration that we linked to in the previous show, but this is one that's being done by the Living Computer Museum, and there are some great shots in their article, which we'll have the link to. But what really got me going is that they've also released Contra Alto, a Xerox Alto emulator, and they took the emulator to VCF and set that up, and I believe they were playing the maze game on it. So they had a series of Alto emulators, and they had an interactive gaming session going.
Cool. Cool. I actually had no idea this was a different alto.
Yeah.
This is a different alto.
Yeah, there's two alto restoration projects going on. So if anyone else there has an alto sitting in their garage and wants to get on the bandwagon, now seems to be the time to do the restoration.
This article you're linking to in Medium.com is also a great example of the lie of alto that I didn't realize was shenanigans that Alto's marketing was pulling until just right around the time of that first restoration. Whereas if you go to this Medium.com site that we'll link to, you'll see the first photo is this big beauty shot of the being restored thing. And it's the monitor and the keyboard, and it's everything you would see in the marketing. It's everything that I thought an Alto was.
Yep.
And that was it, which was amazing and beautiful, and I love the industrial design. But if you scroll down to the second picture, it's more zoomed out, and you see the massive refrigerator-sized thing sitting under the desk that I never knew existed. And it doesn't mean it's not a wonderful and beautiful computer and one of the most perfect I love it. It was so far ahead of its time. It's magic. But I'm still hung up on the fact that there was 90% of the volume of this I didn't know existed.
Yes, it's the
iceberg. They really hid it in the market.
Yes, the iceberg of computing.
Yes, absolutely. So because there's a lot more to this physically. I mean, still, you know, it's still gorgeous and beautiful, but wow. They knew what they were doing in that marketing. Because for many decades, did not know about the lower part of this.
Put the mini fridge under the bench.
Yeah,
and the drive unit.
Because it's like the size of an air conditioner you'd have outside your house. Like it's not a small thing. So just saying. But it's still pretty cool.
And let's see, Ken, you have the next bit of news.
Yes, it's sort of the opposite of a restoration, unfortunately. Seymour Papert, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The co-founder or co-creator of the programming language Logo has passed away, unfortunately. I first became aware of him and his work in Peter Neubauer's line of articles about Logo for JuiceJS. And when I first saw that name, I actually thought it was like a placeholder for a made-up variable or string, because it just sounds sort of fabricated, like maybe something that Bart Simpson would call the bar. But no, Seymour Papert passed away July 31st at the age of 88. I'm reading from the NPR article that says he was a mathematician and computer scientist who spent decades at MIT. His co-founder, or co-creator again with Logo, Wally Feurzig, died about 3 years ago. Logo in Wikipedia is listed as having also been co-created with two other people, Cynthia Solomon and Daniel G. Bobrow. But it seems to be Wally Feurzig and Seymour Papert who take top billing on the creation of this language. This is something that I used when I was a kid in the computer class in my Catholic grade school run by Sister Teresa. And it didn't really teach me much, to be honest. BASIC was far more educational for me than Logo was. I don't think I ever actually made the connection as a kid that Logo was a programming language. I thought it was a drawing program with a really cumbersome UI. But again, Peter's articles for JuiceJS have illuminated me as to the applications of Logo beyond just what I learned in that very under-resourced grade school. So I'm sorry to hear that another co-founder has passed away. The two others that I mentioned, Daniel G. Bobrow and Cynthia Solomon, appear to still be among the living. And there should be a documentary created about Logo, like there was about BASIC 2 years ago for its 50th anniversary. I believe it was Dartmouth College in New Hampshire was the founding site of BASIC, and they produced a documentary about the language. So, yeah, there should be a documentary about this language.
I would also say that Google's self-driving car should have a pen down command.
Right.
That's ridiculous. You're ridiculous.
I think that was a great Logo joke, and they're hard to come by.
this is a. I feel like I kind of understood Logo, but I never interacted with it in the same way that like I guess I was too far along probably by the time Logo sort of came around.
Ooh,
to me,
look at this guy.
Right, exactly. But yeah. So I guess Seymour Papert was again, I don't know how to pronounce it either, so we'll each pronounce it differently, and
Gagne.
someone will be right. But he was a big education proponent So, I mean, the point of this was to sort of like give kids a way to kind of interact with computers and learn how to learn programming topics in an accessible way. And I think so. He wrote a book called Mindstorms, which is kind of and worked pretty closely with Lego to make these kits. You know, so there's a Lego logo kit that you can get for at least for the Apple II. I have couple of these, and I think they do exist for other
of course you do.
Computers as well. And then Mindstorms took up the idea. So there's a brand Mindstorms, Lego Mindstorms, that is like robotics that I think even works on current computers too. So yeah, it's pretty impressive. But and too bad. I think he actually was in a fairly serious car accident, a motorcycle accident, I guess, in Vietnam 10 years ago, and I think this. You know, I think that was basically the end of his kind of academic career, unfortunately. But
yes, that's true. Back in December of 2006, it says that he underwent significant surgery and therapy and had regained most of his abilities. But you're right that a lot of that was not things that one recovers from.
Yeah. So now doubly too bad.
Yeah. But
I guess maybe I'll go next. Continuing on, it sort of seems all thematically related, but the Computer History Museum has just released the beginning of an autobiography written by Gary Kildall. Gary Kildall, of course, is the co-host of Computer Chronicles, author of CPM, founder of Digital Research, and so he apparently had been writing notes, putting together notes for an autobiography that he was intending to publish. So in 1993, he had this kind of draft prepared, and he had given it to, I'm not sure who he gave it to exactly, but his children have just provided it to the Computer History Museum, and it is downloadable, at least the first part of it. So they withheld the latter half of it, which they say don't really reflect him as he was. So this may have something to do with his sort of state of mind as he was writing it. But the first chapters about the creation of CPM and kind of like philosophy of just computers is out there, and you can download it. You're not allowed to distribute it. There's a certain thing you have to sign in order to get it, but it's really interesting, actually. I did download it. I read through it relatively quickly, but my idea of him was much different from what the way he thought of himself, actually. So it's interesting to hear him talk about himself and how kind of surprised he was to have been deemed meritorious enough to take on the Computer Chronicles job. And it's neat to read. I'm not sure that I came away with it with any like epiphanies, but it was really neat to read. So. Gary Kildall died in 1994, sort of unexpectedly. So anyway, if you haven't had a chance to look at that, take a look at that. Have any of you looked at that since it came out?
I have not.
No, I've added it to my ebook for reading later.
And I don't even listen to our podcast.
Yeah. Right. It's rough. It's not in finished form at all. It's really kind of like notes that were going to be turned into an autobiography, but so it's terse and it's very conversational. It's neat. It's endearing. So, okay. And moving on, Carrington, you have something that is not at all Apple related.
It is not. It is something that exploded my mind. One of the nice things about retro computing is that there's a lot of stuff going on nowadays. I think there's a good argument to be made that we are in basically a golden age of retro computing. A lot of people with a lot of experience and time on their hands and the wherewithal to do so are creating incredible hardware and incredible software and doing stuff with the computers of my youth that you wouldn't even be able to dream of doing back in the day. So it's amazing when things are taken to such extremes. And every once in a while, I'll stumble across a project. It'll lead me down a rabbit hole as I learn about what's going on in another platform's goodies. And this has to do with the TRS-80. So something came out called the TRS-80 Box Serial. And not Serial Box, but Box. TRS-80 Box cereal. And its big deal, which I didn't understand at first, was that it lets you use TRS-80 box, whatever that was, without the need for an M1 SE or an M3 SE. And I thought, well, that's fun, I thought. But what the heck are any of those things? So I looked at first into what the M1 SE and the M3 SE are. And I don't know if we talked about them before, but I'm like, what the heck are these incredible things? So they are system expanders for the TRS-80 Model 1 and the TRS-80 Model 3, accordingly. And they add solid-state storage and wired Ethernet and a real-time clock in the calendar and SVGA output and a bunch of ROM extensions and a joystick port and what the heck, a flashy prom general storage thing, because why not? Just bonkers amazing things. So I'm like, well, I didn't know these existed. These are very exciting. So I'm going to link to those. So if you have a Model 3 or 4 or Model 1, these are incredible looking extensions. How awesome. So that brought me back to this TRS-80 box serial, which I guess lets you use TRS-80 box without those things. So I thought, well, what the heck is TRS-80 box? Oh, it's just a way to use Dropbox with those computers. I'm like, what? So there's a Dropbox client for the TRS-80 Micro. And as an Apple user, sometimes I feel really smug that we've got all these amazing things going on with look at our solid-state storage, and someday we might have some sort of stable VGA output. And like just, you know, we've got really cool hardware stuff happening in the Apple community. And since I play in that sandbox, I am out of touch with what's going on with other computers. Well, the TRS-80 is very impressive, and the stuff that's going on in that community is amazing, and they've got Dropbox. So there's a challenge for us Apple II people, because what the heck? So TRS-80 Box has existed for a while, and you can now do it without needing one of these fancy expanders, because why wouldn't you? I didn't know any of this stuff existed. It's all incredibly impressive. And so if you're playing in the TRS-80 space or would like to, you should definitely check out these links.
Yeah, that's
Did any of you guys know about any of these things?
Well, actually, the TRS box was just recently mentioned on the Trash Talkers podcast. So if there are any TRS-80 listeners out there, get thee to the Trash Talkers podcast quickly. Do not walk. Run. Mm-hmm. It is an excellent podcast, and as I said, they covered the TRS-80 and Dropbox on one of their recent episodes, as well as the Mize and the M3 SE. Great pieces of hardware, really gives you so much more functionality with those machines. And yes, I'm exceedingly jealous.
So it's pronounced Mize because it's M1 SE. So
yeah, Mize. Yeah. And there's debate on how to pronounce the M3 SE.
I think Mize was in contention for a while.
Yeah, Mize was in contention. So it's Mize and Mize. But I think even the Trash Talkers are a little bit still in a state of flux as to pronounce the second. But
anyway, it's all very impressive.
It is. Yeah. Yes. Even if they do come up with a great name for it, I think Mize is perfectly fine. It is astounding hardware. I think it is. Both of them are great, great system extenders for the TRS-80s, and I am jealous. It is superb stuff with that Dropbox client, effectively, for the TRS-80.
Yeah, it's crazy. And those expansion things are crazy.
Mega,
and amazing.
Mega crazy. Like
I'm so impressed by it. Mm. And I love the early TRS-80 stuff. I had a Model 1 before I had an Apple II, and I've always loved the Model 3 and 4 industrial design. I think they're totally gorgeous. So, you know, I do have a nostalgic connection to the model line, and I love them. I'm just out of the loop completely, and just sort of, it's like I was going down a retro computer hallway, and I just sort of ducked my head in. Oh, what is happening in TRS-80s? What the heck? So, very, very impressive. Yeah. So well done, guys.
Yeah. I never heard of the TRS box, which I hope they call Trash Box. That is really wild. I know that. Not very long ago, the official Dropbox client went away on I think the like pre-Intel machines maybe or something. There was like some of my old Mac machines that I used to be able to run Dropbox on. It's you know it's given up. You know it no longer works. It's even more recent than that I think. And so I'm amazed that they can actually communicate with Dropbox. I assume that this is. Like, I don't know how they do this. I'm going to have to read up on how they do this, because I would love to see this on other platforms.
Well, you can. I mean, there's a web API, mm-hmm. so it could be just that they're doing that. Like, you can get a listing over is that port 8080 or something like that? It must be.
Yeah.
So maybe they're doing it that way. Anyway, the whole thing is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, it's a super cool idea.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Who's next? I think Ken, you are next. Tell us about the Internet Archive.
Right. So it wouldn't be an appearance by me on the RCR podcast if I wasn't talking about games, right?
Hooray.
Yay. Hey, I love games. Cool games. I brought Lode Runner to Kansas Fest. I did a presentation about indie games on Steam at Kansas Fest. And this week I'm talking about Nintendo Power, which is a little bit off the beaten path from our usual beat, which is, of course, classic computers. But Nintendo Power is a magazine that debuted, I think, around 1988. It was a monthly magazine for Nintendo, of course, as the name implies. They were the publishers of their own magazine. And it ran until December of 2012 from its debut, in June of 1990. So that is 22 years of this monthly magazine, 285 issues. And somebody has begun scanning them and uploading PDFs to the Internet Archive, which is fantastic. Now, of course, Jason Scott has already put a lot of gaming content into the Internet Archive, not only the home console virtual arcade living room that you can play old games in right in your browser, but he also did a lot to scan documentation for actual coin-ops and upload those. I don't believe this is his work, but it is consistent with his sort of personal focus in the Internet Archive. It says that this is being uploaded actually by Sketch the Cow, which I believe is another name for Jason Scott. Mm-hmm. And so I probably should have done more research, as always, before speaking. But it looks like some of these files have been uploaded as long ago as February 22nd of 2016. So that's half a year ago now. But it's just recently been making headlines that a lot of outlets are reporting that somebody uploaded all this Nintendo Power. And not every issue is up there. It looks like there are 145 issues at this time. I'm surprised that they have been up there this long. One of the reasons I assumed that this was news is because Nintendo is very protective of their intellectual property and copyright. So I assumed that this had only been up there for a short time, because that's as long as Nintendo would allow it to be up there before sending a cease and desist and a DMCA takedown notice to have all these articles and issues and PDFs removed from the Internet Archive. So the fact that they've been up there for 6 months is pretty surprising, actually. But now that's making headlines, let's see if it stays up there. If you want to read about the original 8-bit NES, which I believe shared the same CPU as the Apple II and the Commodore 64, or the Super Nintendo, which shared a CPU with the Apple IIgs, and the Apple IIgs was actually a development station for many Interplay games, including Out of This World and Wolfenstein 3D, both of which were then ported back from the Super Nintendo to the Apple IIgs, and all the other Nintendo systems that came out in those times, such as the Game Boy, the Nintendo 64, etc. A lot of really classic stuff. Check out archive.org/detail/Nintendo Power and download 145 PDFs to your heart's content. Was anybody here a subscriber to Nintendo Power?
Nope.
Nope.
Carrington, you're my only hope.
Nope.
Oh, come on, people.
I liked the Nintendo, but I wasn't super into it. I'm very old. So I was like, yeah, I can do better. Yeah, so I dug it. I would like to point out, for everyone who's not American, Out of This World was properly called Another World.
Thank you.
Everywhere but in your country.
Yes, weird. Thank you. So anyway, yeah, it's true that I am probably the youngest person on this podcast at this moment. So this was right up my alley. I was a Nintendo fanboy. I bought into everything they were saying and selling, and to a degree I still do. I've owned every Nintendo home console. And so I thought Nintendo Power was the greatest. And this is at an era when there really wasn't another source for news about Nintendo games. They are, as always, pretty tight-lipped, and there was no internet or even games journalism back then. Most of the time, the way you found out a game was coming out was by seeing it in the pages of Nintendo Power, or by one day it just suddenly shows up at Toys R Us, and there it is. So I found Nintendo Power very exciting. I waited for it to arrive in my mailbox every month, just like everybody else does now every quarter for Juice GS, It was the highlight of my month.
I would like to point out, just to head off the email, there was an internet. There wasn't a World Wide Web.
Okay.
Yes, that's true.
Am I getting... Because we're going to get a lot of email about that. Yes, there was. The internet did exist during this period.
Yes, that's true. ARPANET goes back to the 60s, and there was an internet in the 80s and 90s, but it was not available really to consumers. And
the rest of us were on it, Ken. We just didn't invite you. Because you were one of those Nintendo kids. We didn't want you on. And then AOL ruined everything.
I wonder if there really is a threat of this not staying on the Internet Archive. I mean, like, I know that they do get, certain amount of takedown threats. But I'm not sure how they respond to it. I know they respond to some of them, because I know that when the PC games went up, the MS-DOS games went up some time ago, there were many, and then there were slightly less many. So
well, it goes both ways, because when they put the Intellivision games up, only about half the games in the Intellivision library were there, and they got emails from the remaining staff from Intellivision saying, "We saw your project, and you've put up half of our games, and we're really upset. If you're going to do this, you should do it right. Here are the other half."
Nice.
Perfect.
That is definitely not an attitude Nintendo would take.
I wonder at what point there'll be an intersection, though, because the Internet Archive does amazing stuff with making these games available and playable in your browser, and it's all old things. But at what point will I be able to browse Nintendo Power and click on an ad for an NES game and then play that, because there's NES emulators, they're just not making it available, essentially, in the Internet Archive. At some point, enough years from now, that would be an acceptable thing, I guess, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I wonder at what point things will just get too new and playable, according to people that own this nonsense.
On this, I was reminded when you were talking of the Internet Archive, I recently have just finished scanning all of the Apple Orchard magazines that I have. This was... for some reason, it was an Apple II centered. Well, it was Apple centered, but in the 80s, magazine that was basically combining a bunch of user group newsletters and contributions into a single thing. And for some reason, it wasn't out there. It was kind of a big part of my own, computer magazine reading in the 80s. I liked it a lot. I didn't understand why it wasn't out there. I finally did manage to get. I still don't have any of my original ones. I don't know what they're hiding somewhere in my childhood home, but I managed to reacquire most of them and have scanned them and put them up. So if you search archive.org now, you will find many issues of that. And I've also got a page full of them that I'm maintaining myself. But at archive.org, you have the nice kind of reader, and all these scans are pretty big. But magazines were a big... It's really quite something to read them again. I don't do magazines don't feature at all in my current life, but it is a lot of fun to go back and see those and see the kind of excitement. And there's a month of waiting for the next one to come.
That's something I really like to do at Kansas Fest, to bring it back to that, is there's always the garage giveaway, and there's always a ton of old Apple II and other magazines available. And so throughout the week of Kansas Fest, if I'm sitting in the lounge, I will normally grab one of those, like basically borrow it from the garage giveaway and read it. Just browse through, looking at the ads, it's so much fun to read the articles and see the ads, and then I just put it back and grab another one. So you get this amazing lending library while you're at Kansas Fest of all these magazines, which is... super enjoyable.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I walk away from every garage giveaway with, is not a new or old computer or peripheral or software, but always old nibbles and insiders and A+s. And sort of an Easter egg that I like about those magazines is sometimes they still have the mailing label for the original recipient of the magazine. And most of the times I recognize who that person is. So for example, I recently picked up an old Nibble magazine that had Hugh Hood's mailing address on it. He is a prolific ultra macros programmer for AppleWorks. And I took a photo of it and I emailed it to him and I said, "Hey Hugh, I found something of yours." And he wrote back and he was just delighted to know that his collection is finding a good home and is being put to good use, as opposed to just throwing it in the recycling bin or being put on eBay to make a quick buck.
Right. Yeah, he, a lot of the stuff that was at, I think, Last Times and This Times, maybe just This Times, garage giveaway came from his collection. He was one of the major sources of all that stuff.
Yeah, I think Hugh Hood, Michael Mann, and Ray Merlin were the three biggest contributors in the past few years.
Mm. Really amazing. But yeah, it's what's neat about looking at these old magazines too sometimes is that I look at them and I notice things that I didn't notice at the time. You know, like I see it didn't strike me that this was going to be a big thing or this is like going to turn into a super collectible game or whatever, you know, but I see, you know, a little review of it, whatever, you know, like Sabotage or something. And, you know.
Yeah, I just love browsing through the magazines. I know that so many of them are available online, but there's nothing quite like sitting down with the real magazine. And yeah, I went away with a couple of magazines from the garage giveaway as well, because I like to collect January editions of magazines so that I can basically have a compilation of retro computer history throughout the years, and I just basically take the January magazine as a snapshot so that I can just see what was happening in various years for different models of computers. So, you know, if I've just recently picked up a couple of year sets of TRS-80 magazines and I'm just browsing through those, and you know, I've got other magazines which, you know, I've found, and as I said, I like to take the January issue just so that I can look at the ads, see what was being promised, and sort of comparing that to, you know, did that game actually exist? You know, Vaporware has existed for quite a while, and it's always a good, you say, oh yeah, I remember reading about that, and then what happened? And you sort of find out, well, that was pretty much it. It was something that was promised, a couple of not even screenshots, but a few artist impressions of what the game was going to be like, and then it basically just disappears into the dust of history.
Yeah, sometimes I find that the, I mean, a little late for me to mention this now, I suppose, but the December issues are sometimes good for that as well, because they're targeting the shopping season. So I know that a lot of times the December issue will end up being twice as big, you know, full of ads.
Especially for those magazines, which were almost all ads anyway.
Right. Computer Shopper, you know, came in two volumes. Actually, Michael, I think you're next, maybe just to mention your visit to the LCM.
Yeah, well, the Living Computer Museum was the start of my tour to Kansas Fest. So prior to the Kansas Fest, I went on a fortnight holiday tour through the West Coast up through British Columbia in Canada, and then across to Carrington Land, and then down to Kansas City in Missouri. But my first major stop was in Seattle, so I planned that so that I would arrive on the Thursday. Now, Thursday is fairly important because the first Thursday of the month, the LCM is open till 8 p.m. So I figured that that gave me enough time to fly to Los Angeles, get a flight up to Seattle, check into the accommodation, and then still have plenty of daylight available to go off to the LCM. So popped off there, found a Twitter account just lying around waiting to be used. So I live tweeted my evening at the museum. So Michael's night at the museum. I'll supply a link. Thank you very much, Ken, for putting those tweets through Storyify. It's a nice little memento and a great little giveaway so that people who have never been to the Living Computer Museum can actually have a look at some of the exhibits that are there. So it's just literally a stroll through the museum. There's some shots there. I seem to have concentrated mainly on my favorite systems. So there'll be some shots of the Alto there. And in there, there's kits from the 60s. There's old storage equipment. There's my favorite, the lovely calming green PDP. And there's just so much there. Next time I'm in the area, I'll be going back and just having a look to see what's new, what's been added, and maybe even spend some more time on the Alto this time.
Yeah, it was really fun to see your walk through the Living Computer Museum, which I think just opened 4 years ago. I had never been there and got to live vicariously through your tweets and photos to help me plan my own visit, which was just a week later. And I did some live tweeting as well when I went to the Living Computer Museum with Olivier Gunnar, who lives in the Seattle area and is a former Kansas Fest and Apple II Festival France attendee. He had been there before, so he was sort of my own personal tour guy, which I really appreciate. Had a lot of fun hanging out with him. And I have not storified my own tweets, so I recommend people check out Michael's tweets instead.
Yeah, someday I will get there. Okay, let's see. I guess I have the last of the news bits, I think, that we'll talk about this time. So there was, I forget exactly how this came to my attention. It might have just been released. But there is something called Atom Busmon, which is an in-circuit emulator for the 6502, 6502, Z80, 6809, and 6809E 8-bit processors. And this is a really cool thing. So it's basically, so this is the code for this is on GitHub, and it's been shown to work on, I think, a BBC Micro and a couple other things. But what it is it's FPGA, so Xilinx, I don't know how you pronounce this, the common FPGA company name, but it's an FPGA sitting on a 40-pin DIP board. So you can basically put it in place of like a 6502 or a 6809, and it will analyze and run and emulate those microprocessors so that you can sort of see what's going on. You can break it. You can do small statistics on it and stuff. And it's pretty wild. So it's basically a 6502 emulator or Z80 emulator or so forth that you actually put in your machine and, runs the whole thing. So just the fact that you can do this is really super cool. The fact that you can also then on top of that run statistics or maybe do, fancier things leveraging the 6502 or 6809 stuff is just mind-blowing. So there's a couple of photos of this sitting inside a BBC Micro and then playing, some kind of Defender game using this as its brain. Anyway, it's just I mainly just wanted to point out the existence of this thing and marvel at it and actually the existence of that the hardware the 40 pin DIP FPGA that you can just plug straight in. I think that even not for just microprocessors but also for just like replacing other chips, it seems like it would be kind of a useful thing.
Yeah, I didn't even know about what they call ICE, in-circuit emulation. I didn't even know this was a thing. I mean, I guess it's, of course it would be a thing. I just never really thought about it. This is impressive and very interesting. Cool.
Yeah.
Super cool.
I now want to buy a couple of these things just to see it go. But okay, so I think that can close off the items of interested news. And now a word from our sponsor.
Yeah, I'd like to buy this $1,200 computer.
That'll be $5,300 complete.
$5,300?
What with monitor, software, disk drive,
etc., etc.
Oh.
How much is that $1,000 computer?
$4,400.
Uh-huh. How much is that $1,400 computer?
$3,900.
No, Max. The $1,400 is $4,800. The $600 is $3,900.
I thought the $1,100 was $4,800.
Some computer companies give you a lot of options. K-Pro gives you a complete computer for $1,295.
And we're back. I, being the host, am responsible for finding the retro computing gift idea. And so the thing I came across, sort of thematically related to things we were talking about today, is Robot Turtles, the game for little programmers. And what this is a board game. It comes with little cards, but it is essentially, it's like a little programming game for kids that don't even need to know how to read or whatever. For little kids, you have these cards, you put them in an order, and there are things like move forward, turn right. It's essentially the Logo board game. There's some kind of procedure frog or something that you can get later that will allow you to, the frog can tell the turtle what to do so that you can sort of like learn some kind of iteration, I guess. It's really pretty wild. I'd never heard of this before, and I thought, well, okay, in honor of Seymour Papert, this would be an appropriate gift idea. But actually, it apparently started life as a Kickstarter a couple of years ago and was a massively funded one. I lost track now. I had it open and lost track of what it was, but it was, you know, I think they were looking for, it's something like they were looking for 25,000 and got like 350,000 or something. It was very well backed. I know nothing more about it than this, but I think that's enough. Just even thinking of it as the logo board game sounds pretty cool to me. It is purchasable on Amazon for $18, so $18.25. So it's not a big investment, but looks pretty excellent, actually.
I think it looks super awesome, and I want to play it with other people at Kansas Fest. I don't care that it's for 3 to 8 year olds. I think we will have fun.
Yeah.
This looks great. This looks super fun. If I had a 3 to 8 year old in my life, I would buy this in a heartbeat.
Yeah. It's even more accessible than actual logo because you don't need to be able to type and whatever. It says one person needs to be able to read the rules and kind of run the thing. Otherwise, you can just start.
But just to introduce, it says the concepts behind coding, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it just looks, yeah, totally. Bring it on and we'll play it at Kansas Fest. I'll pick up a copy. Load Runner. It can't be worse than the Load Runner game. So I'd say it's going to rock.
Yeah.
Cool. Nice choice.
So Ken, being the Kickstarter expert, had you seen this before?
No, I don't believe I have. I'm flattered that I am. Wait, this is the Robot Turtles game you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Yes, actually, I have seen this, and I bought it for my nephew for his birthday a couple years ago.
And this is why you are the Kickstarter expert.
Yeah. But I will say that this was actually brought to my attention by, no surprise here, Peter Neubauer. And I consulted with him before I bought it from my nephew because I believe he had also bought it. I have not gotten a review from my nephew. I think he failed that homework assignment, which was attached to the gift. But I
to provide a review.
Yeah.
He's stuck in a loop, actually.
Yeah,
he's
Procedure Frog is.
I think he has failed that assignment then.
Yes.
But yeah, this seems like a cool game, and I hope that he enjoys it. And it does come recommended enough that I went ahead and bought it. So when it first went on Kickstarter, I think it was supposed to be a Kickstarter exclusive, but demand was such that they made it commercially available more broadly, which I'm very excited about because I missed the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I managed to bring it up, and it's they were looking for 25,000 and got 630,000. So quite something. Yeah, I think it's cheap enough. I may just get one of my very own. But anyway, so that's the gift idea. Now we can move on to spending further money on eBay. Carrington, you have the first one.
I do, and I am picking something that I would have picked up for myself if it wasn't for the fact that the shipping is outrageous to come to Canada, unfortunately. It is the Ergotron Mac Tilt. One of the problems with the Toaster Macs, those original ones, the Mac Plus et al., is that they sit quite low. Ergonomically, it's like a little beautiful little thing, but if you try to use them with a modern sensibility, you wonder, why is my monitor so tiny? So one of the solutions to that back in the day, like if you want to lift it up higher, were swivel stands and such. One of the most famous of which I had back in the day it was a Wednesday, was the Mac Tilt. So it lifts it up. Not as useful as some of the other things that existed back then that were little shelves and stuff. This was really just a swivel stand. You could lift it up, but you could tilt it back and pretend it was the Banana Junior or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they're terrific. They come up on eBay every once in a while for usually outrageous prices. This one has $1.75 starting bid, $10 buy it now. Crazily useful. I mean, crazily reasonable. Unfortunately, it's $50 shipping for Canada. So if you're in the States, it's probably more reasonable shipping. Somebody will snatch this up. Because $10 is a crazy good price for something like this. Paul's probably going to buy it while I'm speaking.
I will not, I promise, but it does look cool.
Yeah. Oh, for instance, there's another one currently on eBay right now for $125 buy it now plus $50 shipping. So they go for some reason for ridiculous prices, or at least the asking prices are often ridiculous for these things. $10 is more than reasonable for a way to lift up a Toaster Mac that is actually vintage appropriate. So I dig it, and for $10, it's a steal.
Yeah, I don't think I've come across these before. I always just have them sitting on the desk, and it's not a super comfortable position.
And also, since these are what I like about the MacTilt one is, unlike a little shelf that just lifts it up, this it's got little cutouts for the feet, so mm-hmm. it actually will hold it pretty snug even at an angle. So you can tip the computer back, and it makes it much more pleasant to use. When I had an SE back in the day, I had it on one of these MacTilts, and it's a massive improvement in the how enjoyable it is to sit in front of and use one of those computers.
Nice.
Yeah, I just raised my 512K up by sitting in on top of a SCSI drive and a pair of HD20s.
Mm-hmm. It's not how you pronounce the letter H, but whatever.
All right. Ken, keep the theme going.
Oregon Trail, the card game, launched July 31st, and it is a Target exclusive. That is the big box store Target found in multiple municipalities throughout the country. However, you cannot get it online. You cannot get it, through the Target website, and you can't get it through any other retailer. So if you want to get it and you don't have access to a Target, or in my case, I went to Target and it was already sold out, then your alternative is eBay. At Target, it sells for a reasonable price of about $13, and there will be people charging you a lot more than that online. So I'm linking to a Buy It Now eBay auction for $28, which is more than twice the retail value, but it's the cheapest price I have found on eBay. So I don't know if that qualifies as a good deal or not, but it is a game for ages 12 and up for 2 to 6 players. And I can't really say much more about the game because I've not played it. However, I did find that it was in stock in my hometown's Target. So I sent a relative there to look for it, and he was able to procure 3 copies of the game, which I will not be putting on eBay.
You see, is one of them this one?
It is not, Ken? No. Okay. I bought one for myself, one for a reviewer to cover.
And one for Kansas Fest.
And one, yeah, as some sort of giveaway, whether it's at Kansas Fest nice. Or to a Juice GS reader or whatever. So yeah, you are absolutely correct, Carrington, for once.
Woohoo! And one for Carrington.
Yay. So I don't know if it's fun or not. I probably won't know until I get the review submitted for editing in Juice.js. But I think it's great that this really, really classic IP got its popularity, if not its origin, on the Apple II is being recreated in a new medium for a new generation. And it apparently is flying off the shelves, which is very encouraging.
And it's like the Willy Wonka thing. There are 5 boxes of this out there that will actually give you dysentery. So, but maybe you get one of the lucky ones, Ken.
Oh boy, I got the brown ticket.
So, are card games coming back? Maybe
card games
like
are awesome.
My takeaway here is that card games are becoming hugely popular. Or tabletop games.
I don't think it's just card games. I think certainly card games like Cards Against Humanity and Snake Oil have made games more popular. And that even goes back to collectible card games like Magic the Gathering, Pokemon, and Yu-Gi-Oh! I think card games aren't really coming back so much as they've always been here. But as for whether this game is capitalizing on that trend, why it's coming out now, so many years after the Oregon Trail came out as a computer game, I don't know. This game comes with 58 trail cards, 32 calamity cards, 26 supply cards, 1 laminated wagon party roster, so that you can decide who's in your party each time you play, mm-hmm. or maybe it's for the gravestone, I don't know. 1 erasable marker, 1 die, and illustrated instructions, and the creators of the game, Pressman, have actually created a YouTube video on how to play the game. So I have not watched that video, I don't know how to play, but it does look like, actually there is a photo of the laminated wagon party roster, and that's where you can write down who died, and it is pepperoni and cheese.
Of course.
Tragic the Gathering.
It actually says that on the box. Here lies Andy, pepperoni and cheese.
Nice. No, I'll be interested. I would be interested to see. Maybe I will stop by a Target, see if I can find one. I guess I'll have to find an outlying Target.
Yeah, big thanks to Kirk Millwood and Steve Weirich, who gave me the heads up on this game. I might not have heard about it otherwise.
Target came to Canada, then I think they all went bankrupt. So we showed you what we think of you, Target. No, I don't know.
It's like Radio Shack. Didn't Radio Shack have some complicated thing that involved
very bizarre. Radio Shack still exists, but the stores that were Radio Shack are actually now called the Source by Circuit City, and so they split, and it's so like one person owns the name, the other person owns the business, and it's all just a big mess. Mm.
Excellent.
Yeah, I just wonder if it's available here in Australia, but if not, I think I'll have to make a phone call to get someone to pick me one up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Michael, you have the next one?
Yes.
Moving to Commodore.
Well, quite a few shows ago, we covered the Vampire Accelerator cards for the Amiga. Mm-hmm. So in my eBay offering this episode is the Commodore Amiga Macro System Accelerator card. It's going for the ever so not affordable price of $1,500. When you convert that to US dollars, that's just over 1100. But if you want the real deal rather than a modern accelerator card for your Amiga 1200, this is the one for you. So it was just something that popped up in my search for various system accelerators. And as much as I love all the new stuff that's coming out, I have even a greater love, but not $1,500 worth of love for the accelerators that were made back in the day to get that extra speed out of our systems. Even then, when it was all new, we were wanting to make it go even faster.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think an equivalent modern day FPGA implementation is only hundreds of dollars, not the $1,500 Australian that is in the asking for here. But if you're after the original product, if you're wanting to have your system as to the day, this is the sort of thing that you're looking for. And yes, it's a little bit on the pricey side, but I don't see this pop up too often. Actually, it's been quite a few years since I've seen one of these Macro System Accelerator cards come up on eBay.
Yeah, there is something that's kind of appealing about, you know, having a machine that could, even if it is 2016, having a machine that could have existed in like 1991 or whatever it is, actually running at the full speed. I mean, adding a Vampire is cool, and you know, it's very cool that it's possible. But you know, it's still kind of like a hybrid of current and and old. So
yeah, I always like seeing how the technology and the hardware of the day could be taken to the extreme of what was available back then, because you know, you're looking at the speed enhancement and the functionality that this adds on, and it's quite wonderful to sort of see how someone else has come up with a way of making that machine even faster and even better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I have just miscellaneous things this time. So there's a kind of a nice Altair 8800B with disk drives and a little bit of documentation that you can look at. The starting bid is $3,700, and so it's, you know, I'm not going to bid on it. Though actually, it looks like it's actually fairly close to us, Ken. It's in East Falmouth. But anyway, still not going to bet on it, but it's kind of cool to see that they are still out there and exist.
There is some excellent ice cream in Falmouth.
Ah, so maybe that will put me over the edge to bidding on this.
Two thoughts on that. One, is Falmouth big enough to have an East Falmouth? That just seems like a tall poppy syndrome. Two, that's got to have come from foul mouth, right? Like people down there just swear a lot. It's on the ocean.
Try to, in an attempt to shut them up, they put ice cream into their mouths. Don't know. Ken, do you
know? Well, it's named for the settlement Falmouth, Cornwall, England.
I see.
So as for how that settlement got its name, I will have to get back to you on that. I think it's based on Welsh.
I see.
Oh, well, then it's definitely swearing.
Exactly. Yeah.
But in harmony.
Anyway. Okay, so that's the one, and that's one thing that you won't bid on, and here's another one. I came across a huge lot of 1980s Timex Sinclair computer RAM trump cards, QL, blah, blah, blah.
You're underplaying it when you say huge.
This is a ridiculous auction.
I think Horde is the...
It's a garage giveaway, but it's not being given away. But it's the size. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's basically Sinclair themed. So there's a few, there's a ZX81 or two, Timex Sinclair 1500, 2068 in its box, maybe a couple of them. There's what looks to be a bunch of QLs and boxes and software and tapes and books. And, it's really interesting if you were into Sinclair computers,
but didn't have anything
and didn't have anything, right? This you would then have everything. many non-working computers and working ones, I suspect. It's got a buy it now price of $2,600 and a shipping, at least to me from Pennsylvania, of about $240. So it's a non-trivial, kind of thing. But if you, just decided that you wanted to focus on Sinclair and hadn't gotten anything yet, you could make an offer. It might be worth. It's interesting to take a look at what's there. My guess is there probably are some fairly rare things in this pile, but I thought QLs themselves were pretty rare, and there really seems to be like five of them in there or something. So anyway, interesting to look at. And I guess the last one is no more serious. This may not still be up by the time this gets aired, but it is a vintage AOL Running Man logo plush stuffed toy doll. It is the little yellow AOL guy. Stuff.
And it looks like it's like a vintage thing that was made either by or for AOL, like with an AOL tag.
Yeah, it's actually branded AOL. It has like no other features.
Now, why somebody would want this, I do not know.
Oh, it seems like a sort of an iconic little thing.
I'm still upset about AOL. In fact, if I buy this, I'm going to make a meme that's, you've got fail. I'll just hold it up. That might be worth the $20 actually.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a $20 buy it now. Free shipping to me. So my guess is it's not going to last super long. It only was listed today, but
that's Paul's way of saying that Paul's
buying. I'm not going to buy it. I will not buy it. But
spending all your money on that Sinclair lot,
right? And I guess that's it. I guess we made it through the eBay auctions. And to the closing discussions. I sort of feel like I think all the stuff that I was going to say I already said somewhere. Prior. Anyone else have anything? Carrington, anything you want to add?
Nope. I got nothing. I'm almost over my cough because of Plague Meister there. And CanceFest is amazing. People should go.
Yes. Ken, any closing thoughts?
Retrocompute.
No, just hold on. we'll get there.
That's about as well timed as we normally do it.
It's been so long since I've done this.
Michael.
Nothing new in the retro computing world, but I have been playing with my brand new chainsaw, and that's lots of fun.
Ah. Well, be careful.
Yeah, we're nerds. We don't really wield chainsaws that often.
Ah, you should. It's fun. It's empowering.
A horror movie breakout?
Why not?
A little frightening. And to just mention that the next thing you will hear on the feed is the roundtable that we recorded a while back. So I guess that's it for this show. So you can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can join our Facebook group by just going to facebook.com/group/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and we are a member of the Throwback Network, which is on Facebook and at throwbacknetwork.net.
Where are we on AOL?
I don't know. Good question. Check the show notes.
Excellent.
Please write a review of us on iTunes. That will help people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!